And welcome to the Views from the Oregon Trail. I hope you're all doing well. I must apologize for not having a new episode out in the last couple of weeks. It's been an extremely busy time in my life. I just haven't had the time to sit down and really give you the quality of show that you deserve. But we're back today and we're ready to talk about a whole bunch of fun stuff and some serious stuff while we're at it. So once again, sit back, relax, and enjoy the view.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I hope you all will bear with me today as I'm going to deviate from our normal show format just a little bit. Ordinarily, I will run through a couple of kind of funny or amusing news stories that catch my eye somewhere along the way. However, this week what we're going to do is we're going to separate into just two sections. First off, we're going to talk about movies that are turning 40 years old this year. And I gotta tell you, as a member of the Oregon Trail generation, this list makes me feel old. And I don't mean just old, I mean ready to wear Depends and live at Shady Maples old. This list caused me psychological trauma as I started to go through it. Mind you, of course, this is not an exhaustive list. It's more of a highlight list of movies that I'm a big fan of that are turning 40 this year. Hope this brings back as many good memories for all of you as it does for me. We start today with one of the great pop culture landmarks of the 20th century. Bill Murray and Company busting up some ghosts in the original Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters! If there's something strange in your neighborhood, who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters! One of the gold standards of 1980 cinema, probably one of the best jobs of casting in the history of Hollywood. They had it perfect from top to bottom. They nailed it, and on top of it all, they had, you know, a 200 or 300 foot marshmallow man wreaking havoc in downtown New York, and Bill Murray uttering what, for me, is probably one of the greatest lines in the history of movies: "Nobody steps on a church in my town." Up next, we have the second in one of the greatest series of action-adventure films ever put to celluloid. I give you Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. You know, at its time, this movie actually caught a lot of critical guff, mostly because it had a much darker tone than its predecessor, the original Raiders of the Lost Ark, which honestly, from a psychological standpoint, makes a lot of sense. Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were both kind of going through a dark period in their lives. George Lucas had suffered a series of setbacks in Hollywood, and Steven Spielberg was going through a divorce, a nasty divorce at that. And both of them kind of had a little bit of a rough around the edges mindset while writing this film. So there is a very borderline satanic taste to it, with voodoo and dark magic and human sacrifices being involved. I will be the first to tell you, the legendary Mullah Ram ripping a heart out scene scared the ever-loving bejeebus out of me when I was a kid. These days, I watch it with, honestly, a great amount of respect for the special effects of the era that they were able to pull off that scene semi-convincingly amongst a host of others, including that legendary minecart getaway scene in the volcano. It's mind-blowing to think they pulled that off with a bunch of models and practical effects. Absolutely first class for its era. And of course, it ends with a very humanizing scene for the character of Indiana Jones when he rescues all the little kids. There's actually a scene in that movie that sticks at me forever where Indiana and his lady pal and his sidekick Short Round are unlocking the shackles to all the slave children who'd been kidnapped, and they're all gathered around Indy as he's setting them free, and he just turns around and he has this huge smile on his face at the freedom he's bestowing upon them. And it's the first time in actually the series that you see Indiana Jones acting as a true bona fide hero. That's the moment Indiana Jones became a hero. He wasn't just an action-adventure kind of guy or character. In that moment, he became a true blue hero. On we go to the next movie on our list. I'm not even going to bother with all the theme songs anymore. We're just going to start cruising through a few of these. We've got The Terminator. That's right, the original 1984 starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as The Terminator. We see Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor, the mother of the future savior of humanity. And the most criminally underrated actor probably ever, Michael Biehn, starring as Kyle Reese, the man sent back in time to protect Sarah Connor, and unbeknownst to him and her, the future father of the savior of humanity. Just a great, what should have been a B-rate science fiction horror movie, which turned into a worldwide phenomenon and a franchise starter for the ages. And that brings us to Beverly Hills Cop. Eddie Murphy playing the role he was put on this earth to play, Axel Foley, the Detroit detective, sent on a one-man mission to find the murderer of his friend in Hollywood, California. The fish-out-of-water story kind of gets recycled in all of its sequels, which honestly were very good. There wasn't a bad one in the group. I thought they were all utterly hilarious and great action movies to boot. This movie in particular holds up great, and it will always be remembered as the movie that made Judge Reinhold a semi-star. Okay, so the next movie on this little list here is one that really kind of is held close to my heart. So I'm going to give you the theme song. I'm not even going to say the name yet. I'll just give you the theme song. Let's see how you do. Guess The Karate Kid starring Ralph Macchio and the late, great Pat Morita, you are correct. And you also probably understand the deeper, mystical meaning behind the phrase wax on, wax off. This movie led to the birth of thousands of dojos around the United States and probably bears some responsibility for my own personal love for the martial arts, which started at a very young age and traveled through with me the rest of my life. If it wasn't for The Karate Kid, I could probably tell you that the UFC and MMA as we know it today would not exist, as it was the seed that started the United States' fascination with all martial arts for the most part. And we have Mr. Miyagi and Daniel-san to thank for it. Yes, Nightmare on Elm Street, the movie which gave us the one and only Freddy Krueger, the man of your dreams and a thousand punchlines. The very first Nightmare on Elm Street, which came out in that year, was a psychologically mind-bending kind of movie. It scared you in a different place. It wasn't your dad's kind of horror movie. It hit you somewhere in the prefrontal cortex, right between and behind your eyes. It was meant to attack you in a way that horror movies hadn't in the past. This movie hit you in a place where you knew you had nowhere to run. You have to sleep. And what happens when the danger is on the other side of sleep? There's nowhere to go, there's nowhere to hide, and there's most importantly, no rules. Because everybody knows, in a dream, anything goes. I don't want to run too late on time here today, folks, so I'm going to go through a few of these a little faster. We've got Gremlins, the introduction of the one and only Gizmo, and the rules which we all remember this very day. Don't get them wet, don't expose them to bright light, and whatever you do, never let them eat after midnight. Next up is a slightly lesser remembered movie from 1984 called Red Dawn. Now, this movie was remade about 10 years ago with not nearly the amount of heart or energy that this original had. It starred a very young Patrick Swayze. It had Leah Thompson. It had a young Jennifer Grey in it. It had a lot of stuff. As a matter of fact, I think Charlie Sheen was in it. It was a great movie. The basic premise was that a United military invasion was launched against the United States, consisting of Russia, Nicaragua, Cuba, and a few other communist countries from that time period. And these teenage kids essentially create a guerrilla resistance force, which fights against the invading army. One of the most unique aspects to it was that it really did portray somewhat realistically not only the physical but the psychological toll that being that age and trapped in that kind of a fight would take on young adults of that age, and even some of the adults and surrounding peripheral characters who take part in the movie. It's actually quite a good story. It's very good, and it's certainly not the ending you expect, which is why I think what bothered me about the remake so much is they changed the ending to make it more, I don't know, more acceptable to general audiences, I guess you might say. The original drags you from the beginning of the movie, where you're simply watching a bunch of high school kids interacting with each other, to the last 5 minutes where there's tears in your eyes and your guts are kind of shaking up a little bit, you're breathing heavy. It's a great, great story. Criminally underrated once again as a movie. I encourage anybody who's listening to this, if you have not seen Red Dawn or you haven't seen it in a long, long time, get on your favorite streaming network and give it a watch. I think you'll really, really be glad you did. Closing out our list, our last few, we have to start with Footloose, the movie that made Kevin Bacon a star. It made Kenny Loggins the master of the 1980s soundtrack song. And it was the movie in which John Lithgow began demonstrating for the entire universe that he is, without question, the absolute greatest character actor of his generation, and quite possibly of any other generation. If you don't believe me, I challenge you to watch Footloose, followed by Raising Kane, followed by Harry and the Hendersons, then Cliffhanger, and then any particular episode of Third Rock from the Sun. At that point, I will challenge you to defy my statement that he is the greatest character actor probably of the last 75 to 100 years. If you disagree with my statement, you're wrong. Wrapping things up, we have what was one of the most ambitious films of my youth. A movie which twisted, braided, and spun together a story within a story, which yin and yanged the real world and the fantasy world together, and a movie which caused psychological trauma to an entire generation. If you think of Artex and the Swamps of Sadness and get tears in your eyes, you understand. I present to you for your consideration The Neverending Story. A tale within a tale long before the Princess Bride graced us with its presence. Now, will you all please rise and remove your caps for the playing of the Fantasian National Anthem. And so there you have it, my friends, a group of movies that are turning 40 this year, and by doing so, make me feel so old that I feel like I need to mix up a glass of Metamucil and cry into a bowl of bran flakes. So folks, we're going to take just a very short break while I catch my breath, and we're going to dive into something a whole lot more serious. I really like to keep this show fun, kind of mellow, a little silly sometimes, but I have to talk this week about the civil unrest, the Palestinian-Israeli protests that are currently engulfing our nation's academic institutions. So sit tight and we'll be right back.
Don't change the channel.
Get ready, folks, we're about to go riding on some uneven ground here.
And here we go.
For those of you who've been living under a rock for the last several months, or perhaps were spending some time in a very lovely institution working on your macrame wallet or your keychain made of gummy licorice or something along those lines, there has been a violent conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Before you say it, yeah, I know, what else is new, right? It's been going on for, well, probably, what, about 70, 80 years now? However, unlike previous conflicts, this has drawn on for quite a while, and the death count on both sides has been far more elevated than in previous conflicts, which were usually over fairly quickly. This has drawn on. And as the death count rises in the Gaza Strip, what we're seeing is a worldwide outpouring of concern, and that concern has leaked into the political sphere and has begun inspiring a series of demonstrations throughout Europe and even into the Middle East and some of South Central Asia. Before I go any further, allow me to emphasize, you will not find a greater proponent of the right to free speech anywhere in the civilized world than you will find on this side of this microphone. I may not agree in any way, shape, or form with what you had to say to me or to say in general, but I will fight to the last breath in my body for your right to say it. Now, I want you to remember, I just said, say it, state it, even advertise it. You and every other human being walking on the face of this planet have, in my mind, an absolutely inalienable right to speak your position peacefully. Or, in some cases, to organize peacefully to protest any position that you disagree with. Again, I emphasize peacefully. That brings us to what's going on now here in our lovely little United States of America. It seems that as part of this wider Israel-Hamas war protest system going on around the world, a series of increasingly intense pro-Palestinian protests on a ever-growing series of university campuses began a few weeks ago on April the 17th, 2024. It then began spreading to other universities in the U.S. and in other countries. It seems that the wave of protests began at Columbia University, where a pro-Palestinian student group began an occupation of the campus, including setting up tents across the campus and eventually leading to more intensive behaviors such as barricading themselves in a library and taking over several student halls. Now, this technique has spread now across the country from one coast to the other. A short list of major colleges involved: New York University, Yale University, Emerson, MIT, Tufts, USC, Colorado State, Alabama, Washington University, Northeastern, Arizona State, Indiana University, the University of Illinois, Emory University, Chapman State, UCLA, Columbia, Cal Poly, Georgia, Texas, University of Connecticut, Portland State, Michigan, Michigan State, the University of Western Michigan, University of Pittsburgh, and Vanderbilt. At UCLA, NYU, and New University in New York, along with Columbia, protesters have barricaded themselves in university buildings and in a number of halls. There have been reports of attempts by protesters to stop university and college-sponsored events in Florida, like concerts, sporting events, and even commencement ceremonies from taking place. Unfortunately, much like just about every other situation like this, what we're starting to see is the protests are slowly degrading into incidents of vandalism, theft. We see reports of a hostage situation, destruction of property, looting, and all on harassment of Jewish students not being allowed to attend their classes, being prevented from attending classes or enter onto the campuses by some of these protesters. Now, that's when you start getting into a very, very dangerous territory, when you change from peaceful protest to lawless, violent criminal activity. There have been reports of police departments being forced to use a range of tactics against the protesters, including using horses and police and riot gear, deploying pepper balls, tasers. There have been over 2,000 arrests, and basically having to clear unauthorized encampments by rather forceful means. News reports have identified rooftop snipers being deployed at Ohio State. CNN actually reported some of the journalists covering the protests had been arrested and barred access. It later came out that they were mistaken for protesters and were released upon, basically, once the police realized who they were, they were just journalists, they report on it, they were released. But what we're seeing is a degrading of the meaning of protest. Now again, I totally support everyone's right to protest in a meaningful way. However, once you get into the area where you are barricading yourself into a college library, you're refusing to come out, you're disrupting other people's paid for education, their right to attend class in peace, now you're a criminal. Sorry, that's just the way it is, okay? I am all for peaceful protests. I am absolutely against using what amounts to terrorism and threats of violence against people to get what you want. Some of the images coming out of these recent protests are actually quite frightening. Matter of fact, there was one incident in particular I found really interesting, and that I believe it was UCLA. What happened there was actually a counter-protest led by pro-Israeli students who attacked the encampment of the pro-Palestinian protesters at UCLA. And what happened was there was a great deal of confusion as to what was even happening for at least an hour or two, so that when the police were sent in to respond, they weren't sure what they were walking into, and they weren't properly equipped for what amounted to a clandestine middle-of-the-night attack on an encampment. Unfortunately, I fear the situation is going to get worse before it gets better. And one of the reasons I have to think that is that they have seen a sudden influx over the last couple of weeks of counter-protests seen at UCLA again, MIT, Pitt, University of Pittsburgh, and UCLA are seeing counter-protest movements reported to have engaged with the protesters to begin with. And it's not looking like either side is willing to back down or back up. And they're seeing law enforcement just have to get involved over and over, and it's getting uglier by the day. Now comes the fun part. This is where the politicians start to get involved. President Biden himself has taken some heat over the last week or two because he really hasn't spoken out regarding any of these protests at all. And his critics, along with some of his supporters, have really been pushing him to get involved, at least on some kind of a policy standpoint, regarding protests. This is the part that I find actually kind of amusing about all this. For nearly the last 25 years, if a Republican anywhere said that the sky is blue, a Democrat would say it's green. If a Republican says that something's too hot, the Democrat will say it's too cold. No matter what happens, anywhere, any place, any time, they both stand in opposition to each other. Regardless of how common sense laden whatever they're discussing might be. Now I'm going to play a series of clips taken over the last several days from members of both Republican and Democratic leadership. We'll start off here with Republican Senator Tom Lankford. He was part of a Republican leadership press conference. Here's what he had to say.
We're a nation that prides ourselves on the right to be able to speak out. But we're also a nation that says you cannot go and intimidate someone else in the process. When law is broken on that, then law needs to be enforced. If you do not enforce criminal activity, then you'll get more criminal activity. And we're seeing in some of these privileged universities where they're allowing individuals to be able to come and to be able to clearly violate the law and then assume it's not going to get worse and worse and worse. It is, and it has, and it will continue to, till we actually have clear parameters of, yes, you can speak your mind, but no, you can't intimidate other people. And again, for universities that pride themselves on creating safe places on their campus to literally create environments where they know there's going to thrive in crime and they're going to have people take over buildings and try to relive the glory days of the 1960s and protests, what they're really doing is continuing to intimidate other students, and they know it, and they're winning. When graduations get canceled, when classes have to move, the violent protesters, they're actually winning the day.
No, I gotta admit, that pretty much sounds like par for the course for a lifelong Republican. They tend to be the law and order justice party. Let's hear what Democratic Representative Kathy Manning had to say about all these protests.
The school has provided an opportunity for the students to exercise their right to free speech, but the university also has not just a right, but an obligation to enforce the time, place, and manner of the way students and faculty can protest. And at the same time, they have an obligation to keep students safe, to prevent discrimination, harassment, isolation of students who are having a tough time getting to classes, getting to the library, and getting ready for their exams.
Doth my ears deceive me? But that sounded like agreement? Before we all start drum circles and begin singing Kumbaya together, let's hear what the man, the myth, the legend, the greatest instigator in the history of the American presidency, Donald Trump, has to say.
To every college president, I say remove the encampments immediately, vanquish the radicals, and take back our campuses for all of the normal students.
I'm very familiar about all this.
You know, it's the craziest thing. It really is. It's just the darndest thing, but I would almost swear they agree about something. I mean, this can't possibly be correct, right? Democrats, Republicans, agreeing about something? What's next? Communists and capitalists sitting down to break bread? The Pittsburgh Steelers and the Baltimore Ravens sharing a six-pack? The possibilities are endless. But wait. I must play the logical, reasonable person here and say, while those three actually saying essentially the same thing was wonderful and a heartwarming moment in current political times, now let us hear from our illustrious president, where I'm sure he will get things back to normal, with a statement which will no doubt be in direct and categorical opposition to anything that his political adversaries on the other side of the aisle have said. So let's hear what President Biden had to say.
What's going on our college campuses here. We've all seen the images, and they put to the test two fundamental American principles. Excuse me. The first is the right to free speech and for people to peacefully assemble and make their voices heard. The second is the rule of law. Both must be upheld. We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent. The American people are heard. In fact, peaceful protest is in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues. But, neither are we a lawless country. We are a civil society, and order must prevail. Throughout our history, we've often faced moments like this because we are a big, diverse, free-thinking, and freedom-loving nation. In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points. But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law. Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations. None of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Look, it's basically a matter of fairness. It's a matter of what's right. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. People have the right to get an education, the right to get a degree, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked. But let's be clear about this as well. There should be no place on any campus, no place in America, for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students. There is no place for hate speech or violence of any kind, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. It's simply wrong. There's no place for racism in America. It's all wrong. It's un-American. I understand people have strong feelings and deep convictions. In America, we respect the right and protect the right for them to express that. But it doesn't mean anything goes. It needs to be done without violence, without destruction, without hate, and within the law. You know, make no mistake, as president, I will always defend free speech, and I will always be just as strong in standing up for the rule of law. That's my responsibility to you, the American people, my obligation to the Constitution. Thank you very much.
So there you have it. It would seem that this event has in fact become the great unifier, the moment in American history that brought both sides of the aisle together to stand united against tyranny. So we've reached the near ending of our time together today, but before we go, this is my show, so I am going to get my chance to say my little two cents. We cannot allow ourselves as a people, as a culture, and as a society to reach a point where we are so diametrically opposed in manners of discussion, debate, or topical controversy that we cannot be civilized. Protests break down into destructiveness when those who are protesting fail to rely upon their own intellect and merit to make their point, and instead fall to the lowest common denominator of fear and destruction in order to get their ideas across. However, doing so leaves them emotions when they run high can be destructive. I think of Ram Charan, the Indian actor and sometimes philosopher, who said, "Drama starts where logic ends." I also think of Andrew Carnegie, who said that he that cannot reason is a fool, he that will not is a bigot, and he that is too fearful to do so is a slave. The ability to think and reason through our problems and our challenges and our questions is what separates us from the animals. We can think. We have the ability to control and restrain our feelings and emotions and use logic and intellect in its place to come up with real and constructive answers to our divisions, our questions, and our problems. To do anything less is to reduce ourselves to the level of animals in the field. And we're better than that. I really do believe. When I see protesters smashing stores or looting or destroying a university that they themselves have paid quite a bit of money to attend, I see an overgrown toddler throwing a tantrum because things aren't the way they want them to be. I think of Isaac Asimov, who said that violence is the last refuge of the incompetent. Now, I speak not, of course, of war where your hand is forced into defending a nation or something of that variety, but in the case of social discourse, fewer phrases have ever been more accurate. We cannot allow those who are willing to create fear or who have surrendered to fear to control those of us who know how to use our minds. Bertrand Russell said, "Collective fear stimulates a herd instinct, and it tends to produce ferocity towards those who are not regarded as members of the herd." and thus we see things like bigotry, harassment, anti-Semitism, aggression towards those of a different faith. So many things draw from fear of that which is not just like us. We do not need to agree with everyone or everything that doesn't match up with our own view, our own understanding, and our own perspective. You don't have to, but you most certainly don't have to fear it, and you most certainly have to respect its right to exist. A lot more easygoing attitudes and accepting of other people's right to have positions that are in opposition to our own while working toward a common ground would solve a lot of the world's ills. I think of G.K. Chesterton, the famous Christian philosopher from the 19th century, who said, "Moderate strength is shown in violence. Supreme strength is shown in equitableness." He was right, folks. He was very right. To paraphrase the Bible, a cool demeanor turneth away wrath. And intellect, logic, and reason are the pathway away from dangerous and volatile emotions. Herman Wei said, "Logic is the hygiene mankind practices to keep his ideas healthy and strong." I have to tell you that I really like that one. As a matter of fact, in a perfect world, I'd have that tattooed on the inside of my eyelids because it really fits and it really explains the world we currently live in. I'm going to conclude this week's episode with the following quote in an episode that had a whole lot of them. And I think it fits and it will help us to traverse away from the tidal wave of cesspool-like emotional and violent reactionary approaches that has engulfed academia in this country at this time. I give you once again Isaac Asimov, who said, "It is change, continuing change, inevitable change, that is the dominant factor in society. No sensible decision can be made any longer without taking into account not only the world as it is, but the world as it will be." I think if we all think like that just a little more often, what a wonderful world this could be. And so that brings this episode to a close. Once again, it was great spending time with you all here. I hope you have a great day, a better tomorrow, and I hope you all enjoyed catching the view from the Oregon Trail.